Want to take a trip through history's major events or explore interesting geographical features and even some interesting scientific developments? Well, join us on My Sunday Morning Take every Sunday morning from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. where we look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else to help you understand what is happening in the world. You're now listening to My Sunday Morning Take, the show where we dive into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else in between to help you make sense of how it works around you from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Sunday.
Yes, sir. it, brokenhearted, guilty of what I did to you. Lately since we parted, I truly know that I need you. Yes, I do, because I give it all up for you. 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 I give it all up for you.
Yes, I
give it all up for you.
Yes,
I give it all up for you.
Yes,
I give it all up for you.
Yes.
And welcome, welcome, welcome. Good morning, good morning, good morning, wherever you are. This is my Sunday Morning Take here on your number one talk radio station. And ultimately welcoming you to what is not a... Okay. I don't want to jump the gun, but let's describe what we currently see ourselves in this particular month of August that in some cases we try to think is apparently still winter. I say still winter. You know, you get your regular chilly mornings, and then you get cold mornings, and then you get absolutely cold mornings that are completely indicative of what a, you know, typical winter should be in August. But we are halfway through this month. Ultimately, also, we are slightly perplexed because just last week, it was snowing in South Africa, and for some reason, it's now sort of like dissipated, the particular cold-ish climate scenarios. And from this particular indications, and talking to you about something that ultimately is not a weather report, welcome to this morning session of my Sunday Morning Take, where we step into an interesting conversation we haven't actually dissected as yet here on your Sunday morning sessions, where you'll be in my company from 5 a.m. up until 7 a.m. The interesting thing for this morning's particular conversation is that we get to take a look at India, well, not in its entirety, but some of the particular early formations of what we now know as the country of India. Why are we looking at India? Well, there's an interesting particular time frame part or detail that stems through from the 15th of August 1947 to be exact, primarily, which is the time frame, the particular sort of like designated indication of what India's independence starts from. But an interesting thing the literature review outlined to me was that it was actually a bittersweet victory, because I am lumping the discussion of India's independence of 1947 together with the school of thought of post-colonialism together, primarily because it is designated as part of what they call the UK's or Great Britain's sort of like two particular periods of colonization or colonialism, colonialism. The one coincides with primarily the second half, the 19th and 20th century, with a second particular phrase. It's also, if you look at Africa and places like India and other parts of Asia, primarily Africa and Asia together, we fall part of the, it's a mixed bag. We fall part of what is sometimes also known in historical references as late colonialism and early colonialism. So Namibia forms part of late colonialism. A country like South Africa and a country like India form part of early colonialism. A country like the United States, for example, forms part of early colonialism. I recently saw a map which helped describe Canada, you know, because I looked into something about Canada earlier in the week, and the particular map outlined the periods of European settler time frames, the nationalities specifically, because it was broken up between Spanish, French, and English territories and zones, so you technically knew the nationalities, and then also the time periods until in terms of when much of these particular activities of resettlement took place in North America, and the map showed they would cascade from the what is now known as the East Coast of the United States, where you have the likes of New York City or the state of New York, the Bostons, the Philadelphias, the Pennsylvanias, you know, those particular cities, which were one of the earlier particular parts of settlement by the British on the East Coast of the United States. And if you go a little bit more further inland into the United States, you start getting the French names, the likes of Missouri and the likes of St. Louis, which they say St. Louis, and so on and so forth. Or Louisiana, you know, names like that. But the French particular movement was a lot larger than the British resettlement, because the British were confined to very small territories. The French cascaded from Canada southwards into the rest of the United States, if you look at the modern-day United States as it is. And the Spanish predominantly emanated from Mexico, but they were also limited in many scenarios. Limited in terms of that you did find them expanding into desert communities and into Texas, what is now known as Texas, which later on led to the famous particular conflict zone between the newly formed Mexican government at that stage in the 1800s versus what were those guys though? They were basically just settlers. The people that founded Texas or that defended Texas from the Mexican government, because the Mexican government wanted to claim Texas. And they had the famous Alamo conflict take place. So when we look at these particular, you know, labels around early and late colonialism, a country like Namibia, just to reemphasize it, forms part of late colonialism. Late colonialism, in many scenarios, also had extensive okay, not extensive, but it wasn't as it's obviously not as advanced as early colonialism. South Africa is a good example of it. I don't know if Australia would fit into that particular category, but South Australia would be mid to late, primarily. The whole of South America, the whole of North America technically was part of early colonialism. India definitely was part of early colonialism. I say definitely because the Dutch were first there, and then, you know, when the British showed up, and then the British and the Dutch had their particular conflict in terms of control over these particular, you know, colonial possessions and colonial trade routes, which later on led to the particular access point for the rest of Europe into Asia. So, setting that particular scene, identifying that particular perimeter and the parameters that we're going to operate within for this morning's particular conversation, India had something known as an independence movement taking place, which obviously is something that obviously would have also added, you know, would have been something that would have been seen around the world, primarily for countries like Namibia, South Africa to the south, and other African countries, obviously, because if we all identify Africa's particular troubling history with colonialism, we all know that from the 1960s is the template that we look at, because we're looking at Egypt, we're looking at Ghana, we're looking at... and it's funny that in many cases, African scholars, or even this discussion that David and I attended back on Friday, regarding the AFCFTA, is that in many cases we forget that Egypt was one of the early nations that also achieved its independence from the UK, from the British. In many cases, we start with the Pan-Africanist's view, which is the, you know, the Ghana, the Nigeria, the Uganda dimensions, and then we cascade into the other, and then it comes to DRC, and then DRC falls into complete chaos. And all of these particular things also factors into Algeria and Egypt specifically. And then you cascade into the other dimensions, primarily of what the early moves here on the African continent for independence then stemmed from. And it's very interesting that we don't cite, what's its name? Egypt, primarily. Because Egypt, yes, Egypt, at many stages, in the first half of the first half of the 20th century, Egypt play a strategic particular role for the British. Specifically in the Second World War, where Egypt was actually sort of like ground zero for the conflict against the German army's endeavors in North Africa, primarily that the, you know, Egypt obviously was a key particular oil resource, the same also for Libya, the same also heading into Tunisia. And the bigger concern, obviously, was that how do you basically manage these particular, you know, these particular large territories in a war known as the Second World War, which was technically also based upon the resources. It was primarily based upon oil, and it was primarily based upon, yes, it was technically an imperial plan that the failed Austrian painter had for Europe, instead of an imperial plan somewhere else in the world. So it technically looks like an imperial plan. Now, when we zone in on India's independence movement, primarily because it starts from a particular point, on 15 August, which was technically yesterday, 1947, after 30 years, the Indian independence movement, which was led by Mahatma Gandhi at the time, achieved its goal on 15 August of 1947, as a free and independent India as it was established, and ending nearly 200 years of British rule. The independence movement of India and I now understand the bitter sweetness, but it's an interesting thing that Helmut mentioned it every time, because many countries in the global south who achieve their independences from, from a colonial master have to deal with at great length, and also they suffer from a lot of hooks or tentacles stuck to them by this colonial master. Namibia is no different. South Africa has got extensive economic presence in Namibia. That is the tentacles or the hooks in Namibia from the South African economy. South Africa has got a great presence of British companies in its economy. Those are the hooks and the tentacles of the British. Who else is there? The whole of North Africa, and also of French-speaking West Africa, has got a lot of tentacles left, still permeating in great strength into those French-speaking economies of Africa by the French government or by France. And primarily, if you also go and look at, indications of like the UK, of like Australia and New Zealand, the same particular presence is also identified. I had to add them in as well, because even though Australia and New Zealand and let's say, at great length, South America, they are sort of like good examples of prolonged independence and, and in some way also autonomy. Australia and New Zealand on the one side, being part of the Southern Hemisphere, are technically the Southern Hemisphere's, sort of like advanced economies, should I rather say, or developed economies. Even if you come to Brazil and Argentina, Brazil and South Africa, that would form part of the BRICS coalition. Brazil and Argentina are technically still considered as developmental or developing, even though Brazil has been independent for so long in the South American context, because the South Americans themselves have independences more than 100 years old. To be honest, the only African country that comes close to them, the only African country that comes close to them is technically Liberia. And Liberia was started by the Americans to settle, emancipated slaves from West Africa in a territory that they could call that they could call home for themselves. Now, the Indian independence movement, which was an anti-colonial struggle that spanned almost a century, 100 years, and it was aimed at ending British rule over in the Indian subcontinent. The Indian subcontinent technically includes Pakistan. In today's context of countries, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. Just so that you guys know, it includes those four particular nations. Now, it ended in what is described as a bittersweet victory, as the people of the subcontinent won the freedom and the independence, but yet they were painfully divided into two nations, India and Pakistan. Even though on midnight of between 14 and 15 August of 1947, the triumph was achieved and a landmark moment in the returning of dignity to the peoples of Asia following this particular colonial period. Now, the movement was more than political. It was a renaissance in many scenarios and an inspiration for oppressed nations around the world, primarily to have like a shining light and a shining beacon. The fascinating thing also about India's particular independence, and I call it fascinating, was that it happened immediately right after the Second World War. And you could see immediately right after the Second World War indications. That it potentially was sort of like a, you know, writing on the wall, proverbial illustration of writing on the wall for the British, that they couldn't stay there. They couldn't maintain power for so long. The Second World War technically bankrupted them. Because, you know, but it's, as mentioned, war is an ugly beast, and it is a very powerful and hungry beast. Now, shortly before the stroke of midnight, according to the literature, on 14 August 1947, India's first Prime Minister at the time, Jawaharlal Nehru, made a famous speech that was titled, A Tryst with Destiny. And it goes as follows, and I'm going to slightly read it to you guys. So, Nehru said, specifically at that particular time back in 1947, long years ago, we made a tryst with destiny. And now the time comes when we shall redeem our pledge, not wholly or in full measure, but very substantially. And at the stroke of the midnight hour, when the world sleeps, India will awake to life and freedom. A moment comes, which comes, but rarely in history, when we step out from the old to the new, and when an age ends, and when the soul of a nation, long suppressed, finds utterance. It is fitting that at this solemn moment we take the pledge of dedication to the service of India and her people and to the still larger cause of humanity. The ambition of the greatest man of our generation, that was now citing Mahatma Gandhi, who was behind the particular independence movement, which obviously in some cases has its roots, if you guys should know, in South Africa, because Gandhi did visit South Africa prior to starting the independence movement in India, has been to wipe every tear from every eye. And that may be beyond us, but so long as there are tears and suffering, so long our work will not be over. And so we have to labor and to work and work hard to give reality to our dreams. Those dreams are for India, but they are also for the world. Now there is a reason, dear listeners. I'll quickly end it there before we step into our next musical break. There is a reason why I threw the post-colonial school of thought alongside India's independence at the time. It's because I realized something while looking up the discussion of post-colonialism last year. I read about a little bit about it, watched a few videos about it in terms of understanding post-colonialism. Even though if you are someone that has, you've done your, you know, according to you, you're adequate enough reading, you would realize that the school of thought of post-colonialism technically starts from India. It technically starts from India. And even though the literature that I've got here in front of me in some way balances it in what particular time frame of the UK's particular, exercise of colonialism on the world, whether you were in the early colonial bracket as your country or in the late colonial bracket. Namibia, is obviously, as I once again emphasize, was in the late colonial bracket. 1947 for India, and you take 200 years in the opposite direction, that technically puts it very close to the 1600s. And it is extensive, knowing that there are countries that have been colonized for so long in this world, and primarily how this has impacted their particular, their particular destinies and futures. Now, the reason why I looked up the school of thought of post-colonialism was that post-colonialism This is technically also slightly incorrect. I mean, the scale of colonialism in India, minus 200 years from 1947 takes you to 1740 something. And the interesting thing from this, 1747. The interesting thing from this, obviously, is also that you have to account for the influences of the precursor presences, of colonial powers in your in those countries. I almost said economies, but they were economies, mind you. Precursor colonial powers would have been, for example, things like the British East India Company. Before that, it was the Dutch East India Company. And the interesting thing is, those two companies, still till today, are still the world's historically largest companies that existed till today. But on that note, guys, we'll quickly be taking a short musical break, and we'll be coming back right after that, heading into the rest of our discussion for this morning, taking a look specifically at this discussion of the impact of India's independence, primarily just before the halfway point in the 20th century.
congratulations, all to hear the crowd applaud. It's just this reckless mind wasting time. Lost every time that I fought, with a mind full of madness and a heart full of sadness. I'll go wherever you lead, with a head full of misses. All I've never finished, the person I'll never be. Just stones and clients, way hard on this mind, pushing on doors of all open. I found out any meditation, I breathed till the air ran out. It's just this mixed up mind, wasting time, putting my decisions in doubt. With a mind full of madness and a heart full of sadness, I'll go wherever you lead. With a head full of misses, all I've never finished, the person I'll never be. With a mind full of madness and a heart full of sadness, I'll go wherever you lead. With a head full of misses, all I've all to hear the crowd applaud. It's just this reckless mind wasting time. Lost every time that I fought. With a mind.
Now coming back there from the sounds of Take That, and specifically if you find yourself here, you know, just waking up right now, good morning to you, and primarily, I do hope you have at least a cup of coffee in your hands, or whatever you deem as warm enough, specifically to warm you up for this early morning session here, as I'll be in your company up until 7 a.m. And primarily, where we left off just before the musical break was we were going to step into one of the precursor events specifically that led to the colonization of India in its entirety. Well, we actually need to extend that a little bit further, but obviously British colonialism was the biggest part of India's particular subjugation that occurred, and that is on history primarily. In many cases, you know, the involvement might have followed some sort of a thing. When I say the precursor before the British actually made it formal, is a sense of looking at, you know, what other nations and what other particular involvements were taking place. The British East India Company, which, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, in this discussion. Is in human histories the second largest company ever in human history, after the Dutch East India Company in human history. The British first arrived not as conquerors, but as merchants, drawn by India's extraordinary wealth, which had been famous in the West since the Greek times. They arrived to find India dominated by the vast Mughal Empire at that stage, and which is also interesting is because the Mughal Empire was Islam-based or Muslim-based. It was Islamic. And obviously seeing the current, you know, landscape of India's politics, trying to remove the Mughal Empire's particular influences and positives on what it has done for India's progression or India's particular sort of like key historical events. You know, and this development happened back, I think it's 2023, 2024, when Indian educational experts were citing, those outside the Indian government were citing, you know, that something, this is a step too far, specifically taking local politics into a sense of trying to change implant a narrative within the school history books or national history books of India, specifically trying to erase the Mughal Empire from, you know, its particular influences. Because obviously, if you don't know, there's a weird thing happening specifically in terms of the politics in India, specifically where you've got this, you know, anti-Muslim and pro-Hinduist, you know, politics taking place, which is based on religion. And if you guys have never known what that kind of politics looks like, specifically in Namibia, because many people in Namibia, I think a lot of you fellow Namibians don't know what politics on religion looks like in this country. I knew politics based on religion. I still see it specifically like in my own particular communities, colored/bastard communities. When I say I'm Catholic, they have a, you know, there's some sort of a, an element of surprise, and then they spurt. And there's a colleague here that I also had here, specifically at Eagle FM, that also spurted out the same particular rhetoric and understanding for some reason. And if you guys have never seen politics on religion, I experienced it in the 90s, and it is an interesting and a slightly polarizing discussion, you know, to experience. It's probably one of the reasons why, in many cases, many of the people that I know, which might include a lot of the, you know, colleagues and personal, you know, personal acquaintances, are predominantly Protestant, but their understanding also in how they influence the politics associated to religion also then shapes the particular reactions that occur in the world. And if you've never experienced politics based on religion, I'm saying politics, I'm not using discrimination based on religion. I'm saying politics based on religion, or a society defined by its religious interactions between the various subsets of what makes that society. It is an interesting and a very dangerous platform to be involved in. A very dangerous one, just so that you guys know. Now, since the British obviously encountered the Mughal Empire when they first formally made contact as merchant entities with India, the Mughal Empire had been established in the 16th century by the conqueror Babur, and now ruled most of the subcontinent. In 1613, the Mughal Emperor at the time, Jahangir, granted the British permission to establish a trading post in Surat, Gujarat, which would become the first British foothold in India. Now, over the following 100 years after that establishment in Gujarat, the British East India Company established additional trading posts and also gradually increased its economic and political influence throughout the subcontinent. After the death of the emperor, the resultant emperor at the time, Aurangzeb, in 1707, the Mughal Empire entered a rapid phase of decline, providing an opening for various regional powers, which included the Marathas, the Sikhs, and the northern Rajput chiefs to assert their sovereignty. So, there was a particular time, a couple of years that direction, when the BRICS conversation was heating up, that I referenced to you, the dear listener of Eagle FM, that if you go and look at India, you will hear that they've something similar to what the Australians and the Americans and the, who else has states, and the Brazilians have. Their local authorities or what their regional authorities are identified as states. Now, at one stage, I used the word principalities, right? Because primarily, parts of India's particular history at one stage identified this breakup after the Mughal Empire's collapse. It identified regional installations of sort of like, not regional, should I rather say, but like fragmentation. A fragmentation took place of the Mughal Empire. And the fragmentation were these particular, you know, sort of like claims to sovereignty or claims to autonomy, specifically from a overall, you know, an umbrella authority, which was the Mughal Empire. Now, by the 18th century, there was no longer a single dominant power in the subcontinent. This left the region vulnerable, specifically to colonial ambitions, which obviously then manifested. This then led to conflicts taking place. The Battle of Plassey is one particular, you know, sort of like single bookmark that you can see this particular culmination of colonialism taking root in India. The Battle of Plassey in 1757, part of the larger 7 years war between Britain and France, was a turning point in the British conquest of India. Now, the East India Company at the time had increasingly solidified its position, and it was now regarded by native rulers as a serious threat, because they started realizing this entity is becoming too strong in our country. Now, the Nawab, a ruler of Bengal, Siraj al-Dawla, who favored an alliance with the French, had previously attacked a British East India Company trading posts. And with the help of some of the Nawab's own generals, the British were able to defeat and depose the Nawab at the Battle of Plassey and appointed their own administration in Bengal. Now, this crucial victory marked the transformation of the British East India Company from a mere mercantile presence into a military and political power in the country. So, the company would then go on to consolidate its power over the Indian subcontinent through a series of military campaigns. It established its dominance in Bengal and Bihar with the Battle of Buxar in 1764, in southern India with Tipu Sultan's defeat in the Fourth Mysore War of 1799, and then in the Punjab, which is also a state of India, following the Second Sikh War of 1848 to 1849. Now, by the 1850s, the British East India Company had consolidated its rule over much of India. And remember, the territory I'm explaining to you includes Pakistan and Bangladesh today. Just so that you know, the territory I'm explaining to you that the British East India Company basically achieved in terms of control included Pakistan to the west and Bangladesh to the east. Now, as they obviously consolidated their particular role and their rule over India, it started fostering widespread discontent and a pattern of unrest that produced localized uprisings such as the Sanyasi Rebellion in the late 18th century and the Santal Rebellion of 1855 to 1856. And I still want to understand specifically from historians and people who label indigenized uprisings as rebellions, why would you use the word rebellion? Why, you know, for example, like with the Mau Mau uprising. That's an uprising. But in many cases, historically, the phrase, and, you know, in terms of communication, the phrase rebellion is used so as to say, you know, am I complicit in accepting that, you know, colonialism is a good thing, or why would you use the word rebellion? On 10 May 1857, however, a rebellion erupted in Meerut that would profoundly alter the dynamic between India and Britain. Now, Sepoys, which were known as Indian soldiers in the company service, shot their British officers and marched to Delhi, rallying local troops to their cause. By the evening of 11 May, they had declared the aged Bahadur Shah II the Emperor of India, symbolically restoring the Mughals to power and rejecting British rule. Now, the rebellion of 1857, often called the Sepoy Mutiny in traditional British historiography, spread rapidly across northern and central India. It produced fierce battles at Delhi, Kanpur, and Lucknow, and it eventually involved leaders such as Nana Sahib, Tantia Tope, and Lakshmi Bai, who was also known as the Rani of Jhansi. The word Rani means queen. Yes, like the company here in Namibia. It technically means queen. Lakshmi Bai, in particular, became a legendary symbol of resistance against British rule after the British attempted to also annex Jhansi, using the pretext of the Doctrine of Lapse. The Doctrine of Lapse, specifically, that obviously, you know, that they tried to apply, that's obviously the British, in Indian history, is a formula that was devised by a British nobleman, Lord Dalhousie, who was the Governor General of India between 1848 to 1856, and it was meant to deal with questions of succession to Hindu Indian states. It was a corollary to the doctrine of paramountcy, by which Great Britain, as the ruling power of the Indian subcontinent, claimed the superintendence of the subordinate Indian states, and so also the regulation of their succession, meaning the British could, if they didn't like a political actor that you were putting forward, they would say, you know, he said few things in the past that we're not comfortable with, so we don't want that candidate becoming, you know, your political leader locally. And then ultimately what it also is translated to primarily was that the British technically, as we have now seen, and what I've described to you a little bit earlier in the discussion, is that they would leave tentacles or hooks within your country in some way or another. Now, since they used the pretext of the Doctrine of Lapse, Lakshmi Bai took command of the rebels in Bundelkhand region and fought valiantly before being killed in the battle of on 17 June of 1858. Now, by the end of 1858, the revolt had largely been suppressed. The British captured Bahadur Shah II and exiled him to Rangoon, which is now Yangon in Myanmar, where he died in 1862, marking the end of the Mughal dynasty. In response to the revolt, the British government also recognized the administrative failures of the East India Company, and the British Crown then assumed direct rule of India at that time, initiating the period known as the British Raj. I'm looking at an image of Bahadur Shah II, who was the last Mughal emperor of India specifically, before his particular capture, and then subsequent, what they call that word? Almost said alienation, but the word is right on the tip of my tongue. Before he was exiled, yes. Because that's what happened to, what's his name also? Napoleon was a British. They captured him, exiled him to St. Helena here across from us. If you guys don't know where St. Helena is, it's an island here about 800 kilometers from our coast into the Atlantic. It's a British territory, by the way, so that you know. Just so that you know. Now, the failure of the revolt had also had a profound psychological impact on the local population of India. The sepoys, the native princes, the principalities, the Queen of Jhansi, and the heir of Mughal grandeur had made their stand against the British in that regard, and they had failed. From this time, all serious hope of a revival of the past or an exclusion of the West actually diminished during this particular period. Now, that sets the scene primarily for the first major instances in, you know, if I can call it sort of like the developing world, where, you know, colonization or colonialism died in a very severe manner. One other scenario was also obviously what happened to China at, you know, in a similar particular period, obviously that led to the Opium Wars, and then it's the Opium Wars and the Boxer Rebellion, were the two particular significant conflict zones. And then obviously it's the same thing that almost happened to Japan, but Japan avoided colonialism, which is very interesting. I have to look at the Japanese context. The Japanese context was filled with the modernization that they experienced in the 1800s, plus also the extensive civil wars that they fought, and how the civil wars also included European and even American involvement in the civil wars of Japan. And it was an interesting thing, primarily because the Japanese quickly adopted Western military, tactics, techniques, strategies, and even weapons and technology, even though they could also manufacture their own. And the second thing of that was also that the Japanese then rapidly modernized themselves, but with, you know, in a way, still trying to maintain their own sovereignty, which was very interesting. I still have to identify how they technically did that. Now, obviously, getting back to the India discussion, the traditional structure of Indian society began to then break down, and was eventually superseded by a westernized class system from which emerged a strong middle class with a heightened sense of Indian nationalism. We take a short musical break since we've reached the halfway mark here early on. And we come back right after that.
Woman of wonder, born into the night, all has been forgiven. For the first and the last time, it will all be all right. To this point we have been driven. They drink their brandy and they smoke their cigars, while their old friends scream out their name. She says, we're all just children of the stars. Cover girl, cover boy, of wonder gone into my soul. In your opium apparition, you're a muse, goddess, you're a beacon divine to a man in my condition. She says, follow me, baby, though our tears have been crying. You and I can be forgiven for falling, for thinking that our hearts have both died. In this life we are still living. They stick their thunder and they compare their scars.
We come back there, dear listeners, from the sound specifically of Empire of the Sun with the song Television. Before that, with a little bit of Fleetwood Mac with the song Chain. And, well, Paolo Nutini with the song Children of the Stars. And as we head into the second half of this, or we technically started already with the second half of this morning's program here on your number one talk station, the interesting point specifically where we left off with our discussion, taking a look at India's particular start of its independence movement, was born from this particular indications, obviously, after the failed particular attempts, which you can, in a different kind of political sense, call the royalist failures. I'll call it the royalist failures for now. The label is not here in my literature. But you can technically see that a royalist attempt was made to install what people at the time knew as the only format of government or authority, i.e. install the particular, because in many cases, if you guys don't know, monarchs, royals, in some ways are an identity of a country. If you did not know this, they are in some ways an identity of a country. And obviously with the Sepoy, you know, uprisings and the like, you know, it was trying to achieve a level specifically that they knew themselves before the British technically, you know, imposed colonialism and achieved colonialism in India. And it was an attempt to install back what you knew, what you already were comfortable with or knew about beforehand, you know, before the particular colonialism took place. It was an attempt to put or install what you knew back in its rightful place. Now, obviously, as life and as time obviously went on between 1862 up until obviously the First World War, you know, we're talking about a good 70 years at best, you know, in terms of where, you know, ideas, understandings, and obviously discontent would grow within. This then led obviously the formation of the Indian National Congress, which is one of India's legacy political parties, I would call it. The struggle obviously continued in their context, because on 28 December of 1885, just a couple of like 30-ish years after 1862, the Indian National Congress, or known as the Congress Party in India, colloquially, was formed, and it marked the inception of the first major political, or the first nationalist movement to emerge in the British Empire outside of Britain. Now, it was initiated by someone known as Alan Octavian Hume, who was a retired British civil servant, in collaboration with Indian leaders such as Dadabhai Nauroji and Surendranath Banerjee. The Congress Party was established as a forum for educated Indians to discuss political issues and to advocate for a greater role in governance. The first meeting was held in Bombay, which is now today known as Mumbai. It drew 72 delegates from across the Indian subcontinent. These initial delegates were largely Western educated from elite backgrounds and focused on moderate reforms rather than outright independence when they started out with the discussion. But by the early 20th century, so we're talking about at the turn of the century at 1900, a strong extremist faction had emerged with the Indian National Congress, and that's within them. In response to the British policies, specifically that were obviously being implemented in India, or in the subcontinent of India, especially after the 1905 partition of Bengal, which was widely viewed as an attempt to weaken nationalist sentiment in the region. Now, the partition sparked the Swadeshi movement. Swadeshi translates to of one's own country. Now, the first organized mass action against British rule that obviously took place. Now, although it had declined by 1908, the movement achieved its central aim when the partition was actually annulled in 1911. By 1907, a clear delineation had formed within the Congress between the extremists on the one side, which were led by Bal Gangadhar Tilak and Bibin Chandra Pal and Lala Lajpat Rai. And then you had the moderates on the other side, led by Gopal Krishna Gokhale. And mind you, many of these guys, they weren't young men. They were, you know, advanced in age and the likes, and, you know, they were sharing ideas at the time. Now, this obviously then led to other particular developments also taking place in India. For example, like the formation of the All India Muslim League. Now, the All India Muslim League, which was also the first political party for Muslims in India, was founded in Dhaka, which is now the capital of Bangladesh, on 30 December of 1906. Thus, the development was driven by the increasing dissatisfaction among Indian Muslims with the Indian National Congress. Remember the other party we just spoke about. And the dissatisfaction, which at that time many of these Muslims perceived as primarily representing Hindu interests. Now, the party was heavily influenced by the visionary Indian Muslim leader at the time, Sir Syed Ahmad Khan, who had died in 1898. It had been founded by such leaders as Mian Muhammad Shafi, Nawab Waqar Ul Mulk. I will never get past the Pakistani, and the Bangladeshi names. Nawab Mohsin Ul Mulk, Syed Amir Ali, Mualana Muhammad Ali Juhar, and Sultan Muhammad Shah, who was the league's first president, which was also known as Aga Khan III. That was his other name. Now, Muhammad Iqbal, another particular prominent figure of the All India Muslim League, would emerge as a key voice within a few years of the party's founding. Now, the league aimed to safeguard the rights of Indian Muslims and initially espoused loyalty to the British Raj as a means to achieve greater civil rights and counterbalance the dominance of the Congress Party. That's now the majority in the Hindu party entity at the other end. So you obviously see two major sort of like polarizing entities emerging in this new modernized India, or should I rather say, yeah, India, because it still has the Pakistan and Bangladesh parts attached to it. And you already see the two poles emerging. And the literature obviously cites also that one of the poles decides to align itself closer to the influence, the spheres of influence that the colonial power currently has in the country. And the other one is talking about technically replacing that colonial power outright. Now, the Muslim League would eventually lay the groundwork for the modern-day Pakistan. Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who joined the League in 1913, would later on transform the political party into a mass movement for Muslim autonomy. It then leads into the next chapter, which actually sees Gandhi's involvement into Indian independence realization. Now, Gandhi returned from South Africa at that time, because as I mentioned a little bit earlier in the discussion, Gandhi was in South Africa. If you guys did not know this, he was in South Africa. He did see affairs and behaviors and how technically rights were upheld or diminished or discarded in South Africa. Mahatma Gandhi's real name, Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, later known as Mahatma, which translates to the phrase great soul, was born in 1869 in Porbandar in India, and initially trained as a lawyer in England before relocating to South Africa. Now there, Gandhi advocated for the civil rights and developed his foundational philosophy of non-violent resistance. After spending over 2 decades, 20 years in South Africa, Gandhi then returned to India in 1915 amid the backdrop of World War I and also joined the Indian National Congress at the time. Now, initially, he remained at the he remained on the periphery of the movement, supporting the British war effort and refraining from political agitation. But however, later on, his perspective shifted dramatically following the enactment of the Rowlatt Act in 1919. Now, the Rowlatt Act, if you did not know, set of legislative measures enacted in 1919 by the British colonial government to clamp down on nationalist movements in India. So technically, the Rowlatt Act wanted to ban any idea of an independence movement discussion taking place in India. It allowed certain political cases to be tried without juries and suspects to be detained without a trial. The act was also met with widespread opposition across India, and Mahatma Gandhi's leading the role in the ensuing protests also became a defining moment in his rise as the torchbearer of India's independence movement. And you can obviously see that the Rowlatt Act was not a popular measure that the British obviously enacted in the country. Now, the Rowlatt Act, which I obviously already cited, it empowered the British authorities to imprison suspected independence activists without trial and also allowed for certain political cases to be tried without the juries, as mentioned. The objective of this act was to replace the repressive provisions of the wartime Defense of India Act with a permanent law. Now, Indians felt profoundly betrayed after their support of the British war effort throughout World War I, and resentment then began to spread throughout the country. Gandhi, provoked by the act, announced his initial Satyagraha, which is a clinging to the truth struggle, advocating non-violent civil disobedience, which would then lead to a political earthquake throughout the spring of 1900. Their spring, not our spring. Our spring is here in October. India's spring is technically, because they are technically tropical. So it's technically northern hemisphere aligned of night. And then obviously this led to the particular, you know, groundworks of developments in 1919. But obviously things did not go without much incident, because a massive incident then occurred later on in 1919. This then led to the Jallianwala Bagh massacre. On 13 April 1919, British troops under the command of a General Reginald Dyer fired on a crowd of unarmed civilians in Amritsar, a town or a city. Well, you know, if you've got a country of a billion plus people, you can't call a town a city. You can't call a city a town, technically. Across a place like India. Now, following Gandhi's calls for resistance and a one-day general strike earlier that month, protests had broken out across the country, particularly in Punjab. In Amritsar, following the arrests of prominent Indian leaders, protests had also turned violent on 10 April. Now, a force of several dozen troops commanded by Dyer was tasked with restoring order, and among the measures taken was a ban on public gatherings. On the afternoon of 13 April, a crowd of at least 10,000 men, women and children had gathered in the Jallianwala Bagh, which is a public garden near the Golden Temple, that was nearly completely enclosed by walls and it only had one exit. Now, it is not clear how many people there were, how many people there were who were protesters who were defining the ban on public meetings, and how many people had actually come to the city from the surrounding region to celebrate Baisakhi, which is a actual spring festival that takes place in the city. But Dyer and his soldiers arrived and sealed off the exit. And without warning, the troops then began to open fire on the crowd, reportedly shooting hundreds of rounds until they ran out of ammunition. Now, it is not certain how many people died in this particular bloodbath of this incident, but according to one official British report, an estimated 379 people were killed, and about 1,200 more were injured. And after they ceased firing, the troops then immediately withdrew, leaving behind the dead and the wounded. Now, the shooting was followed by the proclamation of martial law in Punjab that included public floggings and other humiliations to be enacted by the authorities. Indian outrage grew as news of the shooting and the subsequent British actions also spread throughout the subcontinent. Now, the Bengali poet and the Nobel laureate at the time, Rabindranath Tagore, renounced the knighthood that he had received in 1915. Gandhi was initially also hesitant to act, but he soon then began reorganizing the non-cooperation movement of 1920 to 1922, with his first large-scale and sustained non-violent protest campaign that obviously kicked off. The non-cooperation movement and its aftermath then obviously, as you can see, played a big role in achieving the independence in 1947. Launched in 1920 by Gandhi's non-cooperation movement, and it was backed by the Congress Party, it was a mass protest against British authority advocating non-participation in colonial institutions. Indians were encouraged to resign from their titles, boycott government educational institutions, boycott courts, boycott government services, boycott foreign goods, boycott even elections, and eventually refuse to pay taxes. And I like this kind of a thing because it is currently a system that supposedly was observed in not the similar system, but something of a similar nature. If you guys have ever heard of the lying flat movement in China, about young men and young women who are asking the question, where must they break their heads and their skulls, overperform academically to go to university? You know, living these particular, as what they describe as suffocating lives, you know, without seeing any particular benefit to them. Why must they do all these particular, invest all these particular efforts and the likes? It has also led to, what is that movement, that feminist movement in South Korea? Is it the 3B or? It is known as the 3B or it's a letter. Movement specifically where it's driven by a bunch of women. Who say they won't marry, they won't have kids, and they're not going to participate in the Korean cultural stereotype of their country. Is it the 3B movement? Yeah, it is the 3B movement. But it translates from Korean language. So don't try and find the words in English, guys. It's a Korean language, a 3B symbol. Civil disobedience is malign. The reason why I call it malign, because it technically then goes counter to what everything in a law says, you know, in terms of participation. But civil disobedience, obviously, in many cases, are one of the few things that is rarely practiced or rarely observed in societies across the world. But it manifests itself predominantly in societies across the world who want to see major change for one reason or another. I remember that I did touch on the dimension of civil disobedience back in, was it 2023? It should have been back in 2023 or 2022. Primarily because civil disobedience, for a place like Namibia and for Africans, we know about protesting and demonstrating, but we don't really see a manifestation or practice a manifestation of civil disobedience. And civil disobedience, it can end up in severe punishment, like going to being sent to jail and stuff like that. It can end up in severe punishments that could include financial penalties. But civil disobedience, obviously, you know, there was a unique time frame for it. And out of that unique time frame, there was also severe, unique punishments associated to them. I like it because primarily it is something that Gandhi himself was someone that championed it. But before I continue, guys, let's quickly get a caller's contribution through. Eagle FM, good morning.
Ah, before you run away.
Angabana, you know I won't run away anyway. But morning.
You could run away, especially when you are with Helmut. What kind of sentence is that? I don't appreciate that sentence.
Yeah.
It doesn't give us, honestly speaking, now you are educating us,
Yeah.
I had to run and get my pen and my book, even though I started with you. But the problem is that I was not writing. Then I said, I don't write and go, Buana. Then I will miss this girl.
Morning, Uncle Buana. How are you doing?
I said, no, please. Let me not miss this knowledge.
Yeah.
So how are you doing, man?
I'm okay, Uncle Bona. I'm just going into an interesting discussion here because.
Oh my God! And then where is Elmut? He's home.
No, he's coming at 11. Don't worry, Uncle Bona. By that time, I'll be sleeping and recuperating.
Even if you come, it doesn't give us chance. What's the use? I'll just be working and doing my own work. Of course, I can listen because I want to laugh and joke and enjoy myself. But, so thank you very much. Thank you. You know, I did not, you know, today I listened to the song that you always play.
Mm.
Very, I love the songs. So especially when this is the time. And I think you really plan and manage your time very well. This what? How do you call it?
My Sunday morning take. In all honesty, Uncle Bona, it wasn't my first option. This the title of the show. It was
What was the second option?
I actually, in all honesty, I forgot it because it was something I was asked back in 2021. Remember Wanda? He asked me. Give a suggestion, Dwight. And then I gave a suggestion. And then my suggestion was sort of like smacked to the side. And then I get this long name.
What did you say?
I can't remember it anymore, Uncle Bona, because I've been thinking about it for the past 3 months. What was the suggestion I supplied? There was something I supplied. Because I was asked, please supply something. And then I supplied it. And then
supply to give something suggesting what you are going to do.
Yeah, and then the complete opposite of it showed up of that name, because this my Sunday morning take is the complete opposite of what I suggested.
So that means you decided to craft up this Sunday my Sunday take. What's
my Sunday morning take?
My Sunday morning take.
Do you see how long that name is, Uncle Bona?
Oh, my Sunday morning. It's very good. No, for me, I know most. I always know that, yes? Especially like today.
Yeah.
And all these days.
Yeah.
Not that the other days I have been undermining and things like that, but I just thought that I'm missing something.
Mm.
So let's dive in your discussion.
Mm.
And thank you very much. I won't take too long. We can even take too long because I know very few people will come.
Mm.
And these are the programs that we can sponsor.
Mm.
Not necessarily, of course, the comedian, maybe they are cut out for by Menetumbo in the creative industry.
Uncle Bona, you've got jokes, ne?
I'm telling you this.
Okay, Uncle Bona, I'm awake. I'm awake now. Don't worry, I'm awake. Yeah.
Oh. My God. Oh, please. May God forgive me.
That's a classic one, Uncle Bona. That's a classic one. Yeah.
So where are we actually?
Yeah, you were still going to add on the discussion, yeah.
Yeah. You see, thank God. Let me salute Nandi.
Mm.
So we love the history, we know. So those rebellious and how they happen.
Mm.
You see, it's true that, you know, but I will not start from where they were operating, the rebellious, you know, insurgents or whatever they call it. I want to dwell more on Nandi.
Mm.
How he, and others, of course, you were telling me that when they revolted and the barriers,
mm.
they came to install the Mongolia or whatever. I think I have come across the things.
The Mughal Empire.
The Mughal, yeah, mm. empire. And we see that our own empires, they were also very cruel.
Mm.
So you can see that the law that was enacted through Gandhi. What is the name again? You mentioned about this. I think I must organize and put my book. You are going to be my book, what? You guide me how to share my books. Because there are so many.
Angabona, are you talking about Gandhi?
Gandhi?
Yeah.
So now, all I'm saying is that I was trying to contextualize these things into our own system of governance, disobedience to the rules of laws, our behaviors, how they are regulated. You know, because we are the social, you know, we are legal subjects. And we need to have some kind of order. You understand? So we need to, the way we our behaviors and actions are regulated. Just to have that, even the Bible says, yes, so that you live a peaceful and orderly, what is it? Society.
Yeah.
So if we allow chaos, you allow chaos, social chaos and political chaos. And I always see that, yes, there are times when they become like a dragon, what? This kind of laws that impinge on the right and of the people. And they sacrifice themselves. So they even sacrifice themselves just to make sure that, yes, you don't, how do you call it, a non-violence. And people were killed, but of course they paid. Just like in our own history.
Yeah.
People have to, you know, they were those laws that you say, no, you cannot gather. But what I like most is that you ban some of the conduct that you know that you can set the country into fire. Even the martial laws, they are also very important.
Yeah.
For the preservation of who? Of peace.
Yeah.
And order.
Yeah.
So thank you very much. Let me listen before, what time do you say you end at?
At 7. Yeah.
So please, even the song that you play, forgiveness. And you see, religious and the politic. So many people, I think we have been missing, even myself. I'm just trying to learn from your professor, some of the books from your professor, Professor Emily Brown. And I know you will be citing her in your thesis and your books. Isn't it?
Not really, Angabona.
Oh, was she not your mentor?
She was for a couple of subjects. And then obviously that overhaul happened also at NUST. So I don't know if she's still a lecturer, but she was technically a lecturer for, you know, the people and the other students like you, Angabona, before me in that department. Yeah. Because she was the founder specifically of that department at NUST, the journalism department.
Let's look for her. And then we organize ourselves with her. So she has been also helping us in our secular engagement in terms of policing and especially when it comes to editing our documents. So this is known in the political and whatever as chaos. But let's just say thank God for her contribution and teaching. So, Dwight, let me listen. Maybe you play another song for me. Say, yes, forgive me. What is the song?
Which song, Zangabona? Was it the one about Little Lies?
All the song that you praise. You know, I love them so much.
Not a problem.
Thank you very much. So, please, let's adopt a culture of participation and making sure that, yes, we allow some time to enjoy.
Yeah.
But I just feel that from 4, 5, 6, 7. How many hours do you have?
Three.
And all these things, you are just making joke here. You cannot even learn anything. We are learning, not that. I'm sorry. I will draw that to your head.
Angabona, do you know what's the best thing I've learned from working in media?
Let me draw the red face before you go.
No, but do you know what's the best thing I've learned in media, Angabona? Allow people to express themselves. Even if the person is unhappy, even if they are happy, even if they are disappointed, even if they are impressed, allow the expression, because there is information in expression. Yeah, so it's good feedback that you gave Angabona. Don't worry.
We have been giving this feedback all along, and it's just the conservative. Is he not the one who brought you people? You are the one who brought this conservative.
Yes, Angabona. Now, Angabona, I can't practice. What is that word? I can't practice regime change here live on radio.
I understand you. So thank you very much. God bless you.
Okay, Angabona.
Let me conclude your topic, but you continue next time again, Moss.
Yes.
So I think we just miss a lot of... I wanted really to jot down some of the important key points there, but I didn't see, but tomorrow I may forget.
Yeah.
When the exam comes, you say, Angabona has failed.
No, don't worry, Angabona. Let's see each other again.
Thank you. God bless you. Have a blessed Sunday.
You too, Angabona. Now, coming back, dear listeners, from the caller's contribution there, this, where we left off, then obviously led into the subject matter of the civil disobedience and the non-cooperation. Okay, Gandhi called it the non-cooperation movement. But it can also be the civil you can also view it as civil disobedience. Now, the non-cooperation movement also rapidly gained its momentum during growing national anger towards the British Raj, which is the British governance in India, or in that massive territory of three countries today, before 1947. And particularly in the wake of the Rowlatt Act, and the Jallianwala Bagh massacre that obviously took place. Now, the heavy-handedness that the British government had applied and its failure to adequately address the actions of this General Dyer with his actions where he basically went and massacred civilians only intensified the Indian resolve for self-governance. Now, by 1921, the British government, who was confronted with a united Indian front for the first time, was then also seemingly visibly shaken, apparently. I don't know, you don't see it, but the literature explains one thing. The non-cooperation movement definitively shown the potential of a united, non-violent civil disobedience against the colonial regime. Additionally, it marked a transition of Indian nationalism from a middle-class movement to a nationwide struggle. Gandhi at this particular point emerged as the de facto leader of both the Indian National Congress and the independence movement itself. The non-cooperation movement also drew support from the Khilafat movement, which was mobilizing Muslim protest against the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire after World War I. And Gandhi's solidarity with the Khilafat movement also helped strengthen the Hindu-Muslim unity during this phase of the independence struggle. However, Gandhi called an end to the non-cooperation movement in 1922 after an angry mob in Chauri Chaura killed 22 police officers. Gandhi feared that the movement was becoming violent, contrary to its principles, and he also was arrested for sedition in that same year and sentenced to 6 years in prison. If you don't know what sedition is, dear listeners, sedition is usually an accusation that partners alongside treason. Sedition is speech, writing, or actions that urge people to rebel or fight against an established government. It tries to cause disorder or to break the law, but it also falls short of an actual full-scale war or direct overthrow, which is known as treason or insurrection. So, sedition is an ugly accusation. Treason is in its own right ugly, but treason is based on action. Sedition, which is trying to incite something or, you know, trying to spread the idea of something, sedition is an ugly particular charge to face. Now, after he got sent to prison for 6 years, some of the remaining, you know, figures within the broader Indian context, like Jawaharlal Nehru, who was a young leader at the time within the Congress Party, would later on become India's first prime minister when it achieved its independence, had been arrested the previous year for anti-government activity and was released a few months later. Gandhi was then released in 1924, a whole complete 2 years after the time frame, after serving only 2 years of his sentence. By the time of his release, the political landscape had also once again significantly changed. The Indian National Congress had split into two factions, one that was led by Chittaranjan Das and Motilal Nehru, who was the father of Jawaharlal Nehru. And they were favoring participation in the British-dominated legislative councils as a means to gain political influence. And the other side was led by Chakravarti Rajagopalachari and Vallabhbhai Patel, who were opposing this particular approach and advocating for a more assertive stance against British authority. On top of this, the unity between the Hindus and the Muslims had deteriorated, meaning the plan, the unified plan that Gandhi was working on before he got arrested, was busy fragmenting in front of his eyes when he came out. So in 1924, Gandhi was then named president of the Congress Party once again, or he was made the leadership of the Congress Party by then, which was a position that he held for 1 year. It then led to the next phase, the declaration of the Purna Swaraj. So on 26 January of 1930, the Indian National Congress publicly declared its Purna Swaraj, which was a complete self-rule resolution, decisively rejecting the idea of a dominion status within the British Empire and establishing full sovereignty as the goal of the independence movement. Now, it is at this point I'm also going to insert South Africa. South Africa stepped away also from a dominion status. It did it actually in phases. But if you guys remember back to the start of this year when I did the dissection of what led technically to the fall of the League of Nations and to the fall of and to the start of the Second World War, with the focus specifically on Australia's role in the particular sort of like fragmentation of the League of Nations, or the breakup of the League of Nations, was primarily based on the Prime Minister that Australia had at the time between 1917 to 1930-something, where specifically this guy was driving a pro-European immigration policy within Australia to Europeanize Australia to such an extent, meaning he was actively running an immigration program seeking immigrants from Poland, from Lithuania, from Russia, from Germany, from wherever in Europe to come and resettle in Australia so as to increase the European numbers in Australia. Now, if you've never read up on how colonialism, you know, technically works against native populations and indigenous populations across the world, from South America to North America to Africa to Asia to Oceania. This was a mechanism specifically that the Europeans used a lot. A lot. They use it a lot. Or they would convert your territory into a penal colony. If you don't know what a penal colony is, that is the worst that you would actually want or how to be colonized is through a penal colony. A penal colony is a prison colony. Now, dominion status is currently what Australia, Canada, and New Zealand are. They are dominion status. And dominion status means that your head of state is actually still the monarch of the United Kingdom. And the only person of the highest office that you can technically vote for or can appoint where you have autonomy and self-determination on would be, for example, I recently discovered when I looked at that thing that I explained about Canada a little bit earlier in the discussion this morning, I recently realized there's a person above Mark Carney. Mark Carney is the Prime Minister of Canada, if you don't know. He was also the former Bank of England governor. There's a person above Carney that sits between him and Charles III, King of England. There's a person between them, a Canadian, a high-ranking Canadian official. In Australia, I don't know if they've got something like that, but it's the Australian Prime Minister and then the King of England. New Zealand, it's the New Zealand Prime Minister and then the King of England. So if you guys can see, all three of these countries still have technically, in a way, dominion status. I say in a way, it might be watered down in terms of the labeling right now, but it still is dominion status. So India obviously also began its particular take on refusing dominion status, and that obviously led to the particular developments that we saw. But I've only got 2 minutes left. That does bring us up to the end of this morning's discussion. On that particular note, we'll be ending on a musical intervention or a musical break. And after that, we'll be saying our goodbyes, dear listeners. And you can catch me during the course of the week, specifically on the home run, where we'll obviously be dissecting other particular conversations and topics and points of interest during the course of the week.
is getting what she wants. And you're leading her up as she feeds you lies. Stuck in your head but nothing meaningful.
She's having the time, yeah.
Stuck in your head but nothing meaningful.
She's having the time, yeah.
Love her just for now. Wasting your time. You need a little sanity. You've had enough. Wasting your time.
And we come back to listeners, bringing, basically signaling to our end for this morning's session of My Sunday Morning Take. This has been My Sunday Morning Take here on this lovely-ish Sunday morning, actual Sunday morning session. We'll see each other again, as mentioned, during the course of the week, or alternatively back in, or back next week, same time, same place, from 5 to 7, here on your number one talk radio station. Enjoy the rest of your programming in our company, and we'll see each other again.